Today is Wednesday, July 24th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Coming up, Boris Johnson will be Britain's new prime minister.
We are going to energize the country. We're going to get Brexit done on October the 31st. We're going to take advantage of all the opportunities that it will bring in a new spirit of can-do.
Also ahead, former special prosecutor Robert Mueller is set to testify on Capitol Hill. Mark Esper is sworn in as the new Secretary of Defense. President Trump continues his criticism of four progressive congressmen. And how will humans live in space? That's all on today's International Edition. Thanks for joining us. I hope your Wednesday's a good one. Britain's Conservative Party announced Tuesday that former London Mayor and Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson won the election to be its new leader and will become the country's next Prime Minister. Johnson pledged to deliver on his promises to Conservatives.
And I think that we know that we can do it and that the people of this country are trusting in us to do it, and we know that we will do it. And we know the mantra of the campaign that has just gone by. In case you've forgotten it, you probably have. It is deliver Brexit, unite the country, and defeat Jeremy Corbyn. And that is what we're going to do.
What exactly will Johnson taking over as PM mean for Britain and Brexit? For that, VOA's Steve Miller spoke with reporter Amy Gutman in London.
Boris Johnson won by a landslide. He captured more than 92,000 of the party's votes compared to Jeremy Hunt, who captured more than 46,000. So a clear landslide. This was completely expected, maybe not such a massive margin, but this was expected. Johnson has always been tipped to win. And this is basically based on two key points. One is that Boris Johnson has unabashedly vowed to leave the European Union with or without a deal by October 31st, come what may. And so while this may be making certain members of the party quite nervous, it's also instilled a lot of confidence that they can deliver what voters have asked for. Now, on the other hand, the other reason why he's been seen as so electable is because he served two terms as mayor of London, which is typically an area that's more left-leaning. And obviously, he's a conservative. So MPs who are worried about their own seats voted for him for the good of themselves and the good of the party, because this is a time in the UK when both the Labour and the Tory parties are both very divided.
Well, let's kind of talk about the division within the parties and some of the challenges that Boris Johnson may face, because a number of members of parliament have recently resigned.
That's right. He's a very divisive, polarizing figure, not unlike President Trump. He is very clear about his views. He's very provocative. He's very combative. And many say very arrogant. He has ruffled feathers everywhere he's gone, and he often puts his foot in his mouth. So he has a fair few frenemies, as they say, friends and maybe enemies as well. But really, this was a case of loyalty. So some of the ministers that we've seen resign simply don't have allegiances towards Boris Johnson, and also many just simply can't abide him as a character. He's known to have an outrageous temper that gets very aggressive and full of rage, apparently, when he's really angry about something. And this is also about Brexit. So these are cabinet ministers who have said that part of why they're resigning is because they simply can't support even the outside possibility of a no-deal exit on the 31st of October. The problem is Boris Johnson has refused to eliminate this as an option. Now, part of this is a negotiating tactic.
Will Boris Johnson taking such a hard line be effective?
All indicators are that this stance is working, because already, even before the announcement today that he had won the prime ministership, various members of the EU, various leaders of some European countries have already been in contact with Boris, trying to get in place proper negotiations, trying to begin the process already. So it would seem that already it's working, because they said that they wouldn't go back and renegotiate, and yet they appear to be.
That's reporter Amy Gutman speaking with VOA's Steve Miller from London. Taking a look at the top stories in the world, the FBI director says China is the main culprit in intellectual property theft probes, search warrants issued in Puerto Rico texting scandal, Delhi denies asking Trump to mediate Kashmir dispute, U.S. Senate approves bill to extend 9/11 victims fund, and North Korea's latest escalation, a deadly new submarine. Expanded coverage of these stories and more is on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Thanks for being with us. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Former Special Prosecutor Robert Mueller testifies to two House committees later today, but whether he will deviate from his report on Russian interference in the 2016 election is still an open question. Mueller himself has said that the report is his testimony and that he would not add anything to it. Attorney General William Barr sent a letter reminding Mueller to stay within the boundaries of his written report. Barr's staff said that Mueller had asked for written guidance ahead of his testimony. In two nationally televised back-to-back hearings before the House Judiciary and Intelligence Committees, Democrats are expected to try to get Mueller to focus his testimonies on specific examples of U.S. President Donald Trump's misconduct. Adam Schiff is the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee.
I hope that where we are at this time tomorrow is with a better public understanding of the gravity of what the Russians did, the systemic nature of what the Russians did, and the gravity of what the Trump campaign did and what our own president did, how unethical it was, how unpatriotic it was.
Mueller's report said there was no evidence that Trump's campaign conspired with the Russian government during the 2016 election, but did not conclude whether or not the president had obstructed justice. David Weinstein is a former federal prosecutor. He says nobody is going to be fully happy with Mueller's testimony.
I think it's going to start off and conclude as partisan theater. The Democrats are going to be asking certain questions to expand the scope of what they hope is going to be an impeachment proceeding. The Republicans are going to be asking questions that are going to lead to an answer that would say, this is a closed investigation and the results of my investigation are in the report. The only bombshells that might come out of this are, depending upon the way a hypothetical question is posed, he might be able to give an answer. I think for the most part, it's going to be an easy and convenient way for people who haven't read the report to hear from the voice behind the report and point them to parts of the report where the answers might be found.
Weinstein says that committee members of both parties might have to resort to hypothetical questions, something that Robert Mueller is not a huge fan of.
He's not one who likes to live in a land of hypotheticals, but if they're going to press him on a hypothetical and their hypothetical question is posed in a way that if an individual was not the sitting president of the United States and you had the information available and you were not bound by the federal principles of prosecution, would you have recommended that the grand jury return an indictment? I think then they'll get an answer, but it's a hypothetical. And so he may be constrained by the nature of the hypothetical in order to give them the answer they're really looking for.
For his part, President Donald Trump Tuesday repeated his mantra of no collusion, no obstruction, and said the Democrats are being hurt by continuing the investigation. Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell and Judiciary Committee Chairman Lindsey Graham have both said they would not be watching Mueller's testimony.
Are there any senators in the chamber wishing to vote or change their vote? If not, the yeas are 90, the nays are 8. The nomination is confirmed.
The U.S. Senate voted to confirm former Secretary of the Army Mark Esper as the new Secretary of Defense for the Trump administration. It's the first time that the administration has had a confirmed secretary in that job since Former Secretary Jim Mattis left in December of last year. Joining me in the studio is National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden. Jeff, first of all, thanks for being with us. Mark Esper is a former Secretary of the Army. He has said during his confirmation hearings that he will not be intimidated by anyone, no, meaning the president or anyone else, but he steps into a job that has been held by people who were acting in that role but were not confirmed. What does the future hold for him? Do you think he will be able to influence the Trump administration's defense policy, or is it all going to fall behind the resolute desk to the president?
Well, that's the key question. A lot of times it may not be these days whether or not a cabinet secretary, whether it be the new Secretary of Defense, Mark Esper, or anyone else being intimidated of the president, but whether or not they can influence or hold sway with the president when it comes to making key decisions. And right now for the Defense Department, there are several big issues that have come to the fore that will have to be dealt with in one way or another. You have the situation with Iran, where you have rising tensions, especially in the Strait of Hormuz, where there's been some action. The Iranians have seized a British ship, the U.S., and it's the USS Boxer. Marines on board that amphibious ship downed one, possibly two, Iranian drones that were coming a little bit too close and didn't heed U.S. warnings. You have a lot of back and forth in terms of language between Iran and the U.S., which leaves people wondering, where exactly is this going to go? And so you have, what is the military component of that? How does the U.S. come up with enough deterrence to make sure that Iran understands not to push any public negotiations too far and not to rely too heavily on the use of force? There are also concerns with Iran because Iran likes to react to things asymmetrically. So for everything that it's doing in the Strait of Hormuz with oil tankers, what is it doing in places like Iraq, in places like Syria, elsewhere with proxies like Hezbollah that may try to get at the U.S.? These are things the Defense Department has to worry about. There are tensions, of course, with Russia that have been ongoing as Russia continues to modernize its military. There are concerns about China, which has vastly overhauled its military, made it more modern, to the fact where more and more key defense officials and military leaders have been saying that China is a very big long-term threat, but that in part in areas where the U.S. used to have a clear technological competitive advantage militarily, China's eaten into that. In some areas, there have been suggestions in areas like quantum computing, artificial intelligence, which are being used by militaries more and more. There are suggestions that China's ahead. And of course, you have divisions with U.S. allies, most notably recently with Turkey, which decided to go ahead and purchase a Russian-made S-400 air defense system, which meant that Turkey is no longer able to get the U.S. F-35 Joint Strike Fighters, for which it had been making parts. And so Turkey's out of that program, but are there further sanctions that will be applied? Some lawmakers have been pushing for that, and there are schisms, too, with Saudi Arabia, not so much from the administration and President Trump, but from lawmakers who do not like the way and are not comfortable with the way the Saudis have been prosecuting their war in Yemen against the Houthis, a somewhat Iranian proxy. And so all these issues now have somebody in place who can deal with it. Whether or not Esper will be able to influence the president's decisions on these matters, that still is going to be the very big question.
And you also run into situations like happened on Tuesday, where you had some Russian planes come too close to an ally, South Korea, and Japan as well, scrambled fighter jets because there was a violation of airspace. Iran shot down a U.S. drone. There were several tankers that were either struck by mines or were set ablaze in the Strait of Hormuz, through which about one-fifth to one-quarter of the world's oil supply flows. It's like playing a game of Risk with real bullets.
The stakes are enormously high. Now, the one thing with having a confirmed defense secretary is that U.S. allies and partners now have a single person that they can go to, that they can communicate with, a figurehead that they know is going to be there. The need for these multilateral alliances, these strong alliances, as a key component of whatever the U.S. is going to do going forward to keep the world safe in what has been described as an era of great power competition.
And we should mention that Mark Esper took the oath of office and is officially the defense secretary. Our thanks to VOA's national security correspondent, Jeff Selden. President Donald Trump continued his attacks on four progressive congresswomen Tuesday when speaking to a conservative teen summit in Washington. Trump sharply criticized Representative Rashida Tlaib of Michigan at the gathering, saying, "There's no way she stands for the values of the people of Michigan."
This is not a sane person, folks, when you look at that. And this is what we're up against. You have some of that. Now, the Democrats, I guess, are forced to embrace her, and I call it AOC plus three. Okay? AOC. AOC plus three.
Trump also criticized New York Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, a frequent critic of the president's policies.
But she called our country and our people garbage. She said garbage. That's worse than deplorable. Remember deplorable? Oh, yes, you do. Huh? Remember Hillary, the deplorables. She actually said a word that was worse. She said deplorables, and what was the second word? Go ahead. Irredeemables. That's right. She said irredeemable. She said, oh.
Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez did not call anyone garbage. In a March interview about her policies on the minimum wage and guaranteed health care, the congresswoman said Americans should not settle for the current conditions, that, quote, 10% better from garbage shouldn't be what Americans settle for. Last week, the president first suggested the four congresswomen should, in his words, go back and help fix the totally broken and crime-infested places from which they came. Only one of the congresswomen, Minnesota Democrat Ilhan Omar, was born outside the United States, and she is a naturalized citizen. Trump repeated his stance at a rally in North Carolina when the crowd chanted, "Send her back," referring to Congresswoman Omar. The president later tried to distance himself from the chants, but later said those chanting were patriotic and that the women were, in his words, a disgrace to our country. For some perspective on this situation, I talked with Dr. George Lakoff. He's a distinguished professor emeritus in cognitive science and linguistics from the University of California at Berkeley. He told me that the president's remarks are aimed at his supporters and are an attempt to diminish the congresswomen as people.
He's treating them as if they are just people on the street. He's not treating them as if they were elected to Congress by voting citizens. I mean, there's something about this that suggests that they have no rights even as people here, as citizens, much less elected representatives in Congress.
Dr. Robert Futrell is a professor of sociology at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. He says that Trump's statements have energized his base, especially white supremacists.
This is signaling, and it does make a difference. They found something in Trump, and even Richard Spencer has said that, you know, his representation, what he means to white supremacists, has allowed them to sort of create the public presence that he calls the alt-right possible, because it wasn't very public prior to Trump.
Mark Morial is the president and CEO of the Urban League, a nonpartisan civil rights organization based in New York that advocates on behalf of African Americans. He told me that the president's go back statements are very personal to him.
It reminds me of being a little boy in kindergarten and first grade and going to integrated schools where we were a handful of African American students and being told as you left school to go back where you came from, which meant go back to the black neighborhood. You don't belong in this school. You don't belong in this neighborhood. It's highly insulting, and it is racial code, racial stereotype. It is what it is. People know what he means. They understand it for what it says. And it's the kind of thing that is inconsistent with what you would expect from the President of the United States.
Eric Feigl-Ding is an epidemiologist and medical educator at Harvard. His family emigrated to the United States from Shanghai when he was five. He says the president seems to be ignoring American history, that the country is made up of immigrants.
So America is an idea. It's not a bloodline. We're not like some ethnic country that formed as an ethnic majority like many other countries were. And so when you hear that kind of language, people are forgetting the principles upon which this country was founded. It's an idea, not a bloodline, and we have to remind ourselves, we have to keep fighting for that idea to stay alive.
Vanessa Beasley is an associate professor of communication studies at Vanderbilt University in Nashville. She told me that President Trump's remarks often revert to what worked for him in 2016, and it could be foreshadowing his campaign in 2020.
You heard a lot of Trump supporters saying, I like him precisely because he's not acting like a president, right? He's not saying the things we expect a politician to say, I suppose, is what you heard a lot. He says what everybody's thinking, is what I remember hearing. Well, now that, you know, we're talking about some years when he's been in office and continuing to violate what the history, really, of expectations are about the presidency, that to me, that's the question. Is there going to be some level of fatigue, even among his base, of, okay, you know, we got what that was, now we're ready for things to go back to sounding like there's one person who is above the fray. There's one person whose job it is to have a lot of self-restraint and to remind us that we're all united.
This week, Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez criticized Trump for inflaming his supporters. She described violent threats against her and the others as a deliberate and, quote, authoritarian tool used by the president to silence political opponents. Meanwhile, two Louisiana policemen, one of whom suggested on Facebook that Representative Ocasio-Cortez should be shot, have been fired from their jobs. Coming up on International Edition, what will it take to live in space? And a blues icon goes on the auction block. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artist. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
The Senate gave final approval Tuesday to a bill ensuring that a victim's compensation fund related to the September 11th attacks never runs out of money. The 97-2 vote sends the bill to President Donald Trump, who is expected to sign it. Democratic Senator Kirsten Gillibrand of New York said 9/11 first responders and their families have had enough of political games.
Today is not a celebration. It's a deep sigh of relief. We have lost so many of our heroes, and sadly, more will continue to get sick, and more will die.
Comedian Jon Stewart, a longtime advocate for 9/11 first responders who delivered emotional testimony to Congress, said the vote assures those in need of help will get it.
We can never repay all that the 9/11 community has done for our country, but we can stop penalizing them. And today is that day.
The bill would extend through 2092, a fund created after the 2001 terrorist attacks, essentially making it permanent. The $7.4 billion fund is rapidly being depleted, and administrators recently cut benefit payments by up to 70%. This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, an iconic guitar goes on the auction block. But first, last week, the United States celebrated 50 years since man stepped on the moon. Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin were only on the lunar surface for 22 hours. But what would it take to live longer in space? Elizabeth Lee looks at that question.
In the world of science fiction, filmmakers have created different visions of what a spaceship from Earth might look like. More grounded in aerospace engineering, this is a model of what it could look like. Not just a ship, but a habitat that could sustain life for a long time.
The idea is to make a research facility that you could modify things as you go. In the beginning, it might be just a tourist destination.
But the ultimate goal of a space habitat like this one, says aerospace engineering professor Robert Skelton, is solving problems astronauts have been facing since the first person went to space almost 60 years ago.
We've been in space for 60 years, but in zero G, or microgravity, and it's very unhealthy. The pressure of the fluid in your body feels gravity, so the pressure is higher in your feet than in your eye. So in space, the pressure is the same everywhere in the body, and that's too great for the eye, so it flattens the eye. So all astronauts go into space with 20/20 vision, but few come back that way.
That's just one example of health problems that occur in zero gravity. Skelton's habitat would not only rotate to create gravity, but also provide radiation protection and food for sustainability and a growth capacity. This space habitat is designed with a concept of tensegrity.
If you look at these kind of structures...
The word tensegrity is a combination of tension and integrity, just like how the body moves with muscles and bones where they strengthen each other. Skelton says the habitat would start small and the rest would be built in space using many materials outside the Earth.
We want to design robots that can build tensegrity structures in space using materials from space, regolith from the moon or regolith from the asteroids.
Regolith is a layer of material such as rock or dust that sits on top of the bedrock of asteroids or the moon. Skelton says the habitat can initially be in an orbit that goes from the Earth to the moon like a figure eight to mine the moon and get supplies from Earth. Once built out, Skelton envisions trees, animals, lakes and ponds, and an area for growing crops.
The diameter of this thing is 500 meters, which is about 5 football fields.
At its full scale, there would be room for 8,000 people. Skelton says space should not only be accessible to astronauts who are in top physical condition.
We want to open up the space and give some semblance of Earth so that citizens go there and could build a commercially sustainable occupations.
Skelton says the conclusion of this project is ending with a report to NASA. He says if there is a next step, it would be to build structures and samples to test out the materials that could be used in this space habitat. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, College Station, Texas.
One of former blues great B.B. King's signature guitars is set to go on the auction block. Julian's Auctions announced Tuesday that King's Black Gibson ES-345 prototype guitar is among the items from his estate that will go up for bid on September 21st. Julian says Gibson gave King the instrument for his 80th birthday. The headstock has B.B. King 80 and a crown inlaid with mother of pearl. The guitar is estimated to be worth between $80,000 and $100,000. Now, this is not the first guitar to be called Lucille. The guitar that King played got its name when he was involved in a club in Arkansas in 1949 where a fire broke out because two men were fighting over a woman. The woman's name was Lucille. The National Medal of Arts that President George H.W. Bush presented to B.B. King in 1990 will also be up for auction. So are his touring van, jewelry, and some clothing. The 15-time Grammy winner died in 2015 at the age of 89. Thanks for being with us for International Edition. You can find us on the web at voanews.com. Thanks for our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, Greg Burns, and for all the folks here at VOA. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Enjoy your day.
This is VOA News. I'm Michael Brown.